Made in the city. For the city.
We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, your fortnightly food and drink programme for Cambridge. I'm Matt Bentman, and whilst Ruth and Alan are away on holiday, our university news reporter Gigi Perry is joining me in the studio for the duration.
Thank you, Matt. And also thanks to Neil Whiteside for the last 2 hours of music and entertainment with Too Good To Be Forgotten. Now, coming up on today's programme. First, restaurant noise. Have you ever been put off by the overbearing clamour of a loud restaurant? The team investigates what some eateries are doing to combat the problem.
We also visit the new Café Aromi. Now, this is the second Aromi establishment that's just opened up on Pease Hill next to Market Square.
We've also got Alan reviewing the book A Year at Otter Farm, whilst Nazima Pathan from Franglais Kitchen comments on some interesting food blogs that you might just want to keep an eye on.
Aoife Maxwell returns once more with her Cocktail of the Month feature, and this time it's lavender cocktails. And finally, we will wrap up the programme with some coverage of last weekend's Food and Garden Produce Festival on Parker's Peace, featuring an interview with Sophie Grigson. So, let's begin.
So first, Alan has been researching into the vexed question of noise in restaurants.
When you go to a restaurant, you sometimes find you're in a room so noisy that you can barely hear your friends speak. Or you might be somewhere so quiet that you can clearly hear the conversations from other tables, and the people at them can clearly hear yours. Some people do want it noisy. Plenty don't. It's a big issue. Here are the thoughts of some people Ruth met in Cambridge.
Well, we don't like it, so we would probably walk out if it was quite noisy. So if the music was too noisy or if it was like a clunky sort of hearing all the cups and plates banging around cluttering, we probably wouldn't stay.
Yeah. The acoustics, really, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. The sound of the crockery and the general noise.
Yeah. You need a bit of background noise, but you need to hear yourselves think, but just not overloaded, really.
Yeah, that's it. We don't like noise.
A restaurant should be fairly quiet, in my opinion, because you want to rest and you want to chill, you want to enjoy the food and not shout to each other.
So it depends on what kind of restaurant it is to what kind of atmosphere that it should or shouldn't have.
I recently visited a convention in Coventry and we stayed at a Premier Inn and they had a restaurant next door. So the family and I went in one evening and it was too much.
Yeah.
You know, the boom, 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 boom noise. So we just said, have you got a quiet spot? So they took us to a quieter spot, which was still too noisy. So we ended up going to the local pub across the road. It was too noisy. Yeah.
Fair?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's nice to have background music, but not to be sort of like overwhelming when you're trying to eat, or even when you're trying to look at a menu, you're trying to think... You're trying to choose something from the menu and your mind is being distracted by this music, you know. And it seems, I don't know really if it's what people really want or whether they're just trying to draw a younger type of generation, I don't know.
As one of those people said, noise can be used to attract the young. Here's Tim Hayward of Fitzbillies and food writer at the Financial Times talking about the Hard Rock Cafe.
One of my very first restaurant jobs was in the Hard Rock Cafe in San Francisco. And I met the guy who was the founder. He came to visit us one day, and we were chatting about the principle behind the place. He said, you have to understand... He was an English guy. And he said, you have to understand that young American people are often very nervous about restaurants. They feel that they're full of snotty, French-speaking waiters who are there to humiliate them. And you know, most of the people that come in here will come from small towns, and this will be the only restaurant they go to during the year. And he said, so what we worked out was that we needed to give them something to talk about. And so we put stuff on the walls that they would recognise. So everybody recognises music memorabilia, so it gives them something to talk about. We gave them waitresses their own age and food that everybody could recognise, kind of hamburgers and things like that. He said, of course, the other thing is if they can't make conversation, you could always crank the music up and they feel much better. So it actually, for a certain kind of audience group, it really works brilliantly because it they don't need to make conversation. They don't want to make conversation. Yeah. They just want to be there and sort of look at each other, smile a bit, and, oh, I recognise this. And that's kind of nice. The recognition factor makes it comfortable.
Places like Smokeworks in Free School Lane, whose target is younger eaters, are deliberately noisy. It creates an exciting, adrenaline-filled atmosphere, perfect for the food and the clientele. But that's not what everyone wants, at least not all the time. Here's Sarah Lavelle, Cambridge resident and editorial director of illustrated books at Ebury Press, talking about whether noise is much of an issue.
I think it is. It would certainly influence my choice as to where I go. I have a friend who is quite hard of hearing, and we went to a new London pub relatively recently, and we were trying to discuss work, and it was so bad that we actually had to leave because we were just shouting at each other. And when you're watching each other lip read, it's not the best way to get things done. And also, if going anywhere with family when you've got older relatives is extraordinarily difficult. It influences my choice in terms of my dad, who's quite hard of hearing. I do think it's something they should think about.
But why is it difficult to hear people above other noise? And why is it increasingly difficult as we get older? Hearing expert Rosie Frost explains.
Some degree of hearing loss is quite common in older people because your hearing system is very vulnerable to ageing. And a lot of people might have some degree of very mild hearing loss, which they may not even be aware of. But that particularly affects your speech perception, so recognising words. The second part of the changes that happen with age are within the brain, your attention and your memory, in order to process sound, and the ability to pick out sound against background noise is one of the things that becomes harder as you get older. Everybody uses lip reading to a certain extent, and you will do even more when you're in a noisy restaurant environment. And I guess if you're older, then perhaps if your eyesight's a little bit weaker, you struggle a bit more with the lip reading as well. So that can be another contributing factor.
So concentrating on what the person you are speaking to is saying is harder against the noise of what everybody else in the restaurant is saying.
That's right. Your brain finds it harder to pull out that one speech signal against the general background noise.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's nothing you can do to avoid the process of ageing, but it's probably quite sensible to pick restaurants where they have good acoustic environment and you're not struggling to compete in an environment where sound is bouncing off against walls and tables and thus confusing your auditory environment even more.
And do you know if there's any websites that rate restaurants' acoustic environments?
I haven't heard of any particularly. It's an interesting question. But I also think that the difficulty hearing in restaurants is not just one that affects older people. I think younger people do, but perhaps they're just more tolerant of it because it's the place to be seen.
Yeah.
So, what can restaurateurs do about poor acoustic environments, made worse by the fashion for hard surfaces? Richard Bradley is co-owner of Smokeworks, as well as the Cock at Hemmingford Grey, the Tickle Arms, and the Two Chop Houses in Cambridge. I asked him what can be done above noise from the street, not from within the Cambridge Chop House, where we met.
Richard, the fashion in restaurants, and it's a very appealing fashion, is for sort of clean surfaces, hard surfaces,
yes.
And they look great, but it can be very noisy.
Is there anything that can
be done about it?
Yes, at the Cock in Hemmingford Grey and the Tickle Arms, we actually have cassettes that we have suspended off the ceiling, and on the walls at both restaurants we also have what look like pretty bad pieces of art. They do soften the noise.
And because just of what they're made of?
Yes, it's sort of a material we have on the walls. It's like a beige. The ones from the ceiling, I think they're more like a foam underneath a bit of material.
Right, so they just absorb some of the sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Okay.
But they seem to work. Well, they do work.
Yeah.
The complaints, we don't have complaints anymore about the sound.
This question of hard surfaces, what do you do if that's how you want your restaurant to look? Minimalist, with no pictures on the wall. Tim Hayward again.
Yeah, there's some good technology for sand in restaurants. I was really surprised to chat to a chap who was an expert on it. who'd just gone to a London restaurant where they really didn't want to change their beautiful marble on the walls and their hard surfaces and their glass, but it was impossible to talk. And he installed carpet on the underside of all the tables. And if you think about it, of course, it's you can put the same surface area of sound-absorbing material just in a place you can't see it. Mm. So he didn't damage the marble floors, didn't damage the marble walls, just put a thick layer of shag pile under his table. And it helps.
But, as Tim Hayward explained, some restaurants are too quiet.
There's one particular dining room that I went to check out, which is a private dining room on the very, very top of the Gherkin in London. And I thought it was one of the most exciting places I'd actually sort of sat and to chat about. And I was talking to the manageress at the place, and she said, well, we have a real problem with this place, because, of course, everybody here is a city boy, and they're all discussing top-secret stuff. And she said, if you go and stand over there. I went over and stood by the glass on the opposite side where she pointed. And she went and sat on a table on the opposite side of the room and very, very quietly whispered, you can hear me, can't you? And of course I could. Every single word was coming over the top of this thing. And right, I mean, you literally could have eavesdropped a serious banker's conversation. And it was, you know, so they were putting in soundproofing at that point, which made that work better. I think my worst sound experience was going to an extremely pretentious and starred restaurant in another town way away. And we sat and ate. What they'd done is that they had, as many posh places do, they'd had their own crockery made. And this had been beautifully done by some local potter. And it was a kind of very, very highly fired bisque finish. So almost chalky on the surface. And as we all sat in solemn silence eating this really, really pretentious food in this barn-like atmosphere, all I could hear was people's knives and forks scraping on this stuff. And it was just like somebody filing the ends of your teeth with a surform tool. It was just repugnant. It ruined the entire evening, destroyed everything. The review I had to write was quite honestly viperous. But I think sound really, really shot it in the foot for them.
So, restaurants, too noisy, too quiet, and also wildly variable according to the number and the nature of the diners. What do you do if you have noisy diners? You can't tell them to be quiet, can you?
We totally can tell them to be quiet, right. And we do. But not. We don't have a set rule. The buzz in the... One of the great sort of arts of being a maitre d' is to read the buzz in the room. There are some nights when you go in there and there are four tables of eight students and it's kicking off and it's great. And you have people walk in. You know, one or two of the walk-ins might look in, nose around, not for us. That's okay, we've got 40 people seated right now, so fine, next time they might be quieter. We don't want to get a reputation really in any direction to go that way. We just go with it how it is on the night. There are other nights when it's utterly, utterly quiet. You know, a few romantic couples having a little chat with their heads down. And when you're controlling a room, and you really are as a restaurateur, you're controlling the room. You leave the chef to control the food. Mm. But your job at the front is to control the room. Mm. You know, quite a lot of customers, you know, they may not even know that much about food, as long as the food's of good quality. Mm. But what really makes them realise they've had a phenomenal evening is the way so many of those subtle little things go. And sound is a really, really key part of it. I mean, certainly, if you're walking the room and you see somebody in the corner who's leaning in, you know, the hand behind the ear, or if little furrows in the corner of their eyes where they're trying to concentrate, you know, you do think about, so, you know, is the room too loud? What can I do? Should I offer them another table in a quieter corner or something along those lines? Yeah. All of those things are possibilities.
Yeah. Is music the answer? If a place is too quiet, turn it up for a bit of atmosphere. Or if the place is noisy, turn it down. Easy, surely.
Quite often my staff will ask, you know, please, can we have piped music? Because they like music to work to, and it gives the place some buzz. I'm massively resistant to, if you need an atmosphere in a place, you know, putting music in, which is kind of, it's almost like putting on wallpaper that says something about you, then you know, you're not creating sufficient atmosphere anyway. I said, genuinely, if you feel that the room is doesn't have enough bustle in it, make some noise. You know, talk to each other, talk louder, raise your voices, bring people up with you, and that starts to work. If we did put music in, particularly in Cambridge, I think we'd lose more customers than we'd gain. I really do. I think it's really key that people can sit and work in Fitzbillies, and I think there's a lot of very probably more than most other cities, some really intense and interesting chat going on. They don't really want to hear bloody elbow coyly playing over the top. It's just not, it's not necessary. If you need atmosphere enough to put music in, you've already lost. Change the atmosphere, improve the atmosphere, and deal with that music, and you will then won't have to deal with the worm can of what it is you're putting in.
Yeah. That was Tim Haywood. But what do you think about noise in restaurants? Are there any in Cambridge that are getting it right or getting it wrong? Do let us know. You can text us on 07919 070 490. Tweet at Cambridge 105 or email, while we're on air, studio@cambridge105.fm. This is a story we'll be returning to.
And thanks to Alan for that. And in addition, you can email us your thoughts on restaurant noise. Our address is flavour@cambridge105fm. I've certainly been put off two restaurants and a cafe in Cambridge as a result of noise. Noise created by stone walls that were generating simply so much echo, you end up fighting above the other customers, and it really spoiled my experience. Still, it was great to hear Tim Haywood mention the carpet being attached under the dining tables. Such an elegant solution.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Now, if you grow your own food, you'll probably be doing rather a lot of gathering at the moment, as well as beginning to plan for next year. The book we're reviewing today will perhaps inspire you on both fronts. So here's Alan and Ruth with more.
So what's the book about?
Well, it's written for people who grow and cook food, and, you know, maybe they have an allotment or a vegetable plot in their garden. And there's a bit of advice on growing, you know, what sort of soil, when to plant, when to harvest, and then what to do with the food once you've harvested it.
So plenty of recipes, I take it.
Yeah, and really interesting ones, unusual ones. And in the style of Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, he writes a brief essay on the things he grows and how you could use them.
For example?
Well, it's quite autobiographical. Like, for example, when he talks about when he was a child and he sneaked crisps to bed, but now he makes his own from chervil root and parsley root. And he says that roasting brings out the best in these vegetables. So he'd talk about it through a little anecdote, really.
How's it organised?
Well, there are all the things to harvest for each month, with notes about how to use them, how to grow them, and then a section on the recipes.
You said there were some unusual crops. What kind?
Well, like Devon sorb apples.
Never heard of them.
Me neither. apparently it's a rare small tree native to Devon. Mexican tree spinach.
Also never heard of that.
Japanese wine berries. No.
I guess very unusual then. Will they grow in Cambridge?
Yeah, well, I don't know. They grow in Devon, so I don't know. The only problem with Cambridge might be that it's a bit drier than... But he does give growing advice, saying what sort of soils the plants like. But, you know, you don't have to get into obscurities. There are common things in the book as well.
Such as?
Runner beans, peas, courgettes, coriander, sprouting broccoli, parsley.
The usual crowd, then. Are they good recipes?
Yeah, and again, some very unusual ones. Broad bean hummus... Mm. Celeriac and lemon thyme creme brulee, roast plums with labneh almonds and honey, cucumber ice cream.
Wow, they look good, and the photos look really nice too.
Yeah, it's really good quality. You know, the book is a really nice book.
Who is it Mark Diacono?
Yeah, he was the head gardener at River Cottage, so this sort of link with Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, you know, has roots.
Is he a good writer?
Yeah, he's a very good writer, and actually his last book won the Guild of Food Writers Award for the quality of his writing. So it's very well written, it's inspiring, it excites me, it makes me think, I'm going to try planting that, or I'm going to try making that dish. But if you're not easily excited, it's a book you could just sit and enjoy reading.
Yeah, no, it is beautiful to look at.
Yeah, so it is, say again, A Year at Otter Farm by Mark Diacono, and it's published now. In fact, I think it came out in July, available in Heffers and Waterstones.
And we'll be reviewing more books on future programmes. And if there's one that you particularly like, do let us know about it. You can contact us by email on flavour@cambridge105.fm. Or, if you're on Twitter, send us a tweet at flavour105.
And you'll also find a link to A Year at Otter Farm on our podcast page, accompanying this episode. So you can check out the book cover and content description.
Now on to the second in our series about food blogs now. Here's Alan speaking with Nazima Pathan of Frongler Kitchen.
Nazima, are there any particular food blogs, which are good if you just want inspiration. You're not quite sure what you're going to cook or how you're going to cook it. You want inspiration.
The best way to probably find imagery, because imagery is what draws you into cooking, as if as with any cookbook, what attracts you is the picture.
Right, so is there any site that you think's got pretty good images?
One of the ones I use a lot, and people, a lot of foodies are using a lot, is a website called Pinterest, P-I-N-T-E-R-E-S-T, and Pinterest.com is a great source of beautiful pictures of all kinds of things. It's not just about food, it's lifestyle and interiors, and artists put their imagery, but it's an image search sort of scrapbook for people, and you can build your own scrapbook of what inspires you. So it's a great place to start for looking for attractive food or and searching for recipes you might want to make.
So how does it work? You'd see a picture and you think, wow, I like the look of that, I'd like to
so you
make
click on
that.
The picture. And you can, there's many things you can do. You can either click through to the recipe and then obviously, you know, get the recipe. Or what you can do is, if you're researching and wanting to find different ideas, you can create your own scrapbooks, own pin board, and you can then pin that to your own profile. And then other people can also see what inspires you. So you build up your own following if that's what you're interested in. But if you are not and you just want a resource, then it's a great place to put all the sort of, like in the old days where you might take scraps from newspapers and collect your recipes here. This is a way of collecting recipes that might be attractive in one place, and you can categorise them so you can have as many different pin boards as you like.
Okay, could you give us one or two examples of good-looking recipes that are on there?
There are just so many. You know, it depends who you follow and what you're looking for. I follow, for example, Great British Chefs that we'll talk about in a moment, and they have beautiful food from a lot of the Michelin-starred chefs. And then it's very, very American website, so there are a lot of American food sites and bloggers on there, and some interesting recipes from across the Atlantic. Aside from that, really, it's overwhelming. You could find anything from sweet things, healthy things, vegan, vegetarian, barbecue, everything.
If you can eat it, it's on there.
Yes, and usually people put their best pictures on there, so it's more attractive than looking through Google.
Should we go on to Great British Chefs then?
Great British Chefs is a really nice site. What it's done is it's got recipes and food stories that are UK and seasonal, so it suits the British cook. It commissions recipes from top chefs as well as from bloggers. I contribute now to their recipe collection too. Essentially, what you can do is you can find what you can do a recipe search based on ingredients you're interested in. It'll highlight other things that might suit you or that you might like. Or you can go through what is seasonal. It's a great resource and beautifully photographed. I think they commission a professional photographer for the chef recipes to go and actually photograph them. So it's a great site, because then you don't have to click through to anywhere else. Everything's on there. So that's a nice one.
So could you give us one or two examples of what's on there?
Oh, so for example, they've got a lovely langoustine recipe by an Italian chef. We did a recipe from there for a scallop and prawn roulade for one of our supper clubs, which was by Simon Holstone, and they've got fantastic desserts. There's some beautiful sort of, you know, chocolate tarts and other seasonal desserts in there as well.
Right, okay. So that's Great British Chefs. Yep. Any others that you would recommend?
Another British one is lovefood.com. It's sort of like online magazine, really. So it's not just about recipes. It'll be about what's on food television. It'll talk about Great British Bake Off. It'll talk about what's seasonal and local food festivals. So it's quite a nice site in general. But it does have, again, it commissions a lot of chefs to do recipes for them. So it's an interesting site and a great place to find recipes as well. And then from the American point of view, there's obviously some excellent sites that particularly I like too. One of them is called food52.com. Beautiful site, beautiful, easy to navigate, with a range of recipes from easy to complicated, but very much focused on very, very beautifully photographed food to inspire you. And I subscribe to their mailing list. It gives great ideas for midweek meals, for example. And the other American one that's quite good is called The Kitchen, without the E. So it's K-I-T-C-H-N, and it's a really pretty site and has really inspiring recipes. It's always nice to have a different perspective from another country. So coming back to sort of searching for, if you have an ingredient or a particular recipe in mind, in the old days, you know, I used to use Google image search a lot, but now, because it often isn't, it's putting in everything in there that might vaguely be associated, some of the more curated sites are better. Huh. One of the best is Food Gawker. It's a place where people submit their photographs and then they select and have quite a stringent process, so only the very best pictures, apparently, according to what their editors like, gets through.
And do you think they're good?
They are very good. There's another one called Taste Spotting. It's okay. It's good as well. I think they're both very useful for searching. So if I'm looking to make something unusual, I'll always look on there because you know you'll get good images that might take you to interesting recipes.
And are the recipes good as well? Because, I mean, I can see that the editorial team at Food Gawker can judge photographs very quickly, but unless you actually
they're not testing
try the
recipes.
Recipe.
Exactly, yeah, they're not testing the recipes. So as with any food blog, you are reading a recipe of someone who's doing this, who isn't paid to do it, generally. So, you know, you have to judge for yourself how well written it is and adapt. I think that it just takes a bit of reading and you'll see, you know, most of them have, you know, most food blogs are pretty good.
Yeah. But occasionally, I guess, you'll read through a recipe online which perhaps hasn't been edited particularly well by the person who wrote
it. Absolutely, the editing.
And you're finding step five is to take something off the stove and never told you to put it on in the first place.
Exactly. And that's right. These people have written this and haven't, you know, got anyone else overlooking it. So
So the answer is to read through yourself in advance, I guess.
Yeah, and also, you know, just using this as an inspiration. And I often, you know, will look at two or three and then make my own way forward rather than following a recipe to the letter. These are not tested in the same way that cookbooks are tested.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you will get a huge variety and more up-to-date inspiration than you would from a cookbook.
Yeah. So. Well, one of the things that's inspired me recently is some nasturtium flowers, which were still looking healthy in our garden. And is there much on sort of eating?
Yeah, so in fact, there's a very beautiful food blog that a friend of mine writes. Her name is Urvashi Rose. She was on the Great British Bake Off a few years ago. She's a fantastic cook, mainly vegetarian, and she was particularly sort of inspired by that. Her website is called The Botanical Baker, botanicalbaker.com, and it is a site where she has an allotment and she uses her produce and flowers and makes beautiful pictures and writes very well.
Right. And could you give us a couple of examples?
So, for example, a really clever one that she's done very recently is where she's grown beetroot and used the beetroot in making tagliatelle and topped it with pesto made from the leaves from carrots. So carrot-top pesto, which, again, you know, it's a really clever idea. And those are the kind of ideas that, you know, you just might not see in cookbooks.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of, you know, these are trends sometimes. So it's...
Yeah. Oh, that's a brilliant idea.
And the details of those blogs, again, are Pinterest.com, which is a great source of pictures for inspiration, GreatBritishChefs.com, LoveFood.com. These are all .coms, by the way, so don't worry about that. Food52.com. You like that one, don't you, Gigi?
I do. That's one of my favourites. TheKitchen.com. foodgawker.com, tastespotting.com, and finally thebotanicalbaker.wordpress.com. Now, all of those will be linked to you on our podcast page again, so don't worry about writing them down. And don't forget that you can also read Nazima's blog in the media section of her website at frongleykitchen.com.
Your city, our city, because we live here too.
Cambridge 105.
Still to come on Flavour, we've lavender cocktails with Aoife Maxwell and a visit to last weekend's Food and Garden Produce Fair held on Parker's Peace.
Now, Alan, Matt and Ruth attended the opening of the new Café Aromi last week. Here's some clips to give you an idea of the inaugural evening. The first voice you'll hear is of the owner, Francesco Genovese.
First of all, I wanted to thank you everybody for coming. As you know, we are a very young company. We couldn't really be happier so far for the feedback we have had. We have been open now for slightly over a month and the gelato and the pasta and everything else has gone really well with people that live in Cambridge. It's in our DNA. We have been doing it from day one. So we will never lose our quality, our authenticity. So guys, I just wanted to thank you so much for coming and cheers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now enjoy our savory delicatessen, and then in a bit we will have some obviously gelato as well. And homemade brioche as well. Enjoy, guys. Thank you.
Okay, so we're just outside of Aromi's second cafe now. And I'm talking with the food photographer. You're responsible for all of the artwork that's adorning Aromi's walls. Are there any tricks involved with food photography?
There used to be. I've heard that many years ago it used to be like the fake roast chicken. It used to be actually a raw chicken just painted with Marmite and horror stories about fake ice cream not being edible at all. Nowadays, the trend is to prepare fresh food, very good to eat, and imperfection is trendy, is good, and is appealing. And the best bit about the shoot is that you get to eat everything. So that's a big bonus. So it's good that it's edible. So no, everything is prepared to perfection, and everything is natural. And yeah.
Do you know why this change came about? Is it simply because of a change in camera technologies and a change in methods?
Probably changing more, can I say, aesthetic. I notice American food photography tend to be more perfect, picture perfect. You will have the perfectly crisp salad leaves and the perfect sandwich. In Europe, is you know, imperfections are good. It doesn't matter if the skin of the roast chicken is not crispy all over. What matters is that it looks juicy and it's more appealing to our taste, the fact that it's not completely orange or, you know, completely perfect.
All the food that you photographed in Aromi, can you tell that it is very clearly Sicilian food as opposed to a heavy Italian influence? Does it have more of the Sicilian style and method to it?
Absolutely. It is pure, 100% pure Sicilian, not only in the type of food, but how it's presented. So definitely, yes, it's very, very Sicilian looking.
Is there any appropriate way to describe that, what the Sicilian look is, in a sentence?
I would say it's deep colours. You have the aubergines and the peppers and the tomatoes, pistachios, obviously, which is beautiful green. And then for Aromi, for example, also in their interior, the tiles, the colour of the wood, that all contribute to the image of Sicily.
The whole design is...
The whole look is very Sicilian. To me, it's very Sicilian.
Now, one thing I didn't know about Sicily is that they have lots of sugarcane. They have confections combining fresh fruits, nuts, Eastern spices and chocolates. Between the cannolis here, the marzipan, the cubiata, the cassata, they also do marmalades, but they're also very, very big on ice cream. Now, I've got Ruth here stuffing her face with bacio. Did I pronounce that right?
I don't know, I'm not Italian. I think so. It sounded right.
So this is a chocolate ice cream in a brioche.
Yeah, and it's not just chocolate, it's chocolate hazelnut with roasted hazelnut. So that's the ice cream. It's really good, yeah.
I wonder if they got your Savoia cake here, Alan. I was listening to one of your earlier reports, and there was a bit where Francesco gave you some Savoia cake, a very rich chocolate cake, lots of layers, chocolate cream, hazelnuts, full of elegant decorations.
Yeah. I'm not sure that they... I don't know. I've not seen it since, actually. It was incredibly dense. It really was. It was... It's not something you could eat a lot of, but though you would want to.
And I love this opening as well, the design of the shop, to have just one large window that opens up, revealing all of the ice creams that you can buy on the street as you're walking past.
When they took the place on, they didn't know about this window.
Oh, they didn't?
No.
Really?
He was saying, Francesco was saying just before, that when they took it on, this window was covered with a metal screen. And they, I mean, obviously they realised there was going to be a window behind it. But when they took the metal screen away and they discovered that Francesco's father-in-law saw the sort of mechanics and realised that the windows slid up, and they just didn't know that. And they're just one of the reasons they're so pleased is because it's a listed building. If they'd had the idea of having a window like this, they couldn't have installed it because it would have been a dramatic change to the building. So it was just purely fortuitous.
What a stroke of luck, as they say in London.
Oh, yeah.
So here we are at the end of the night, and I'm with Ophelia Genovese. How do you think it all went? This has been the second grand opening of
yes.
a Remy. Just a few doors away from your original place.
Yeah, indeed.
And it was so packed. I'm glad we're outside because it's been so busy in there.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's been a great evening, actually. And I think it's been a great success tonight.
And it's been a little bit enlightening for me as well to see how you put all of this together. I've been talking with some of your designers and photographers.
Yeah.
Everything that went into making this feel like a little taste of Sicily.
Yeah. I mean, this is 100% authentic. And the fact that it's run by Sicilians. I mean, I'm one of, you know, I used to live in Sicily and 13 years ago now, and my husband was living in Sicily as well, and so as our partner, so it couldn't really be more authentic than that. So yes, it's Sicilian 100%.
So I expect we'll see long queues piling out of here in future as well.
Yeah, so far it's been good. I mean, gelato is definitely a great product, and people in Cambridge are really loving it. The fact that it's homemade, it's fresh, and it's got fresh fruits and the best ingredients from Italy is just bringing a completely new product to Cambridge, I think, and you know, customers are loving it. Hence, you know, all the queues that we got.
Have your offerings changed over time? Since you first opened last year, your menu then compared to how it is now, has it developed?
Yeah, definitely. I would say yes. Obviously, some of the core products are still there, pizza, but definitely focaccia is one of the new products. We didn't have focaccia when we first opened, so that was a new addition. But also with the pizzas, we had the opportunity to add new products. So we got pasta and we got salads, which we didn't have the opportunity to have on Venice Street, simply because the space in the counter was quite limited. So I would say, yes, food is developing, and we always try to bring, you know, authentic flavour, but also new flavours.
Okay, thank you very much, Ophelia.
It's my pleasure. Perfect. Yeah.
Café Aromi, it's the taste that sells it. Rich, deep, layered textures. From the brioche to the cannolis to the gelato, it's just a beautiful experience in their new café, just a few doors down from their original shop on Pease Hill near the Market Square.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And now it's over to our cocktail of the month.
Right, Aoife, what have you got for us this month?
Okay, well, this month I wanted to do something which really reflected my philosophy around cocktails. And I was trying to think what that was, get it sorted in my head. And I suppose it came down to doing some preparation in advance, using what's available around you, but then having a cocktail that's quick and easy to make on the day. Because sometimes I put a recipe up and people say, oh my goodness, rhubarb vodka, I couldn't be bothered making that. And I say, you know, pull yourself together, put in a little bit of work at a time when you're... You have some time, you know, it could be a Sunday morning. We're not talking about doing something where you have to drink a drink then, so it could be a late one Wednesday night or early a Sunday morning. Make something. And the thing that I've made this week is a lavender cordial.
Mm-hmm.
This year, one of my successes is a lavender hedge that I've grown on my allotment, just to separate the beds and to keep the bees happy. And it really was so beautiful when it was in full bloom. I mean, it was really fantastic. And the amount of bees that I had on there, it was really lovely to see.
That's a really good idea, actually.
Yeah. I've taken some and dried it for various uses. This is some here. But I wanted to use some of it fresh as well. And I had great ideas about baking and all sorts of things that I never got around to. But one thing I did do was make the lavender cordial. And all I really did was take fresh lavender, so I cut it fresh, pulled off all the little flowers and steeped it in boiling hot water, as if I was making tea or something like that. And I let it sit for about an hour. But you could do a little bit shorter, actually, because it was very strong in the end. And then I just made the same syrup that I always make. So in this case, it was very strong with lavender flavour, so I put a lot more sugar in to try and balance that out. So in this case, I did 2 parts sugar to 1 part water. I just measured how much water I had. Let's say I had 1 litre of the lavender steeped water. I then used 2 kilograms of sugar, so that kind of ratio. I did this with fresh lavender, but equally, if you got some food-grade dried lavender, you could do the same with dried lavender. So even though we've moved on a little bit now, season-wise, since we had fresh lavender, you know, it's still something that you could do. So once I made my cordial, I just bottled it up with my usual tablespoon of gin and keep it in the fridge. It just keeps that a little bit longer. So that's my prep work. I've done it. It's been in the fridge for a while now, and I kept having, oh yeah, I must do something with that, you know, but I've done the hard work one day when I was feeling energetic. And I was very lucky in that a friend of mine went off to South Wales and visited the Adnams Brewery, which is a great, you know, pretty local to us resource.
Yeah.
Brewery and distillery, actually. And I'm a big fan of their gin. And they brought me back a bottle of gin. And I actually thought the lavender and the South Wales gin was a good combination, because lavender is often grown in that part of the world as well. You know, some of the fields as you go out that way, it can be full of lavender, and up to Norfolk as well. So it really felt fitting. And I suppose I was also kind of thinking wistfully at this time of year of summer drifting past. And lavender is always that smell, you know, of kind of nostalgia and dreams and all of those type of things. So that's where it all came together. But really, this is very quick and easy.
Right.
So what we're going to use, we're going to use a big slug of gin. So 40 mils of gin into our glass. This is actually the only alcohol in this cocktail, so it's going to be quite light at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But there still is 40 mils of gin in there. We're then going to use 40 mils of our lavender cordial. And actually, when it's diluted, it goes slightly pinker. And I think you'll notice it go pinker again once I add the lemon juice. So I'm going to use some fresh lemon juice. And to make life easier for this cocktail, because I was really thinking, what's really simple? I'm doing 40 mils, 40 mils, and 40 mils. Easy to remember. So I'm just squeezing this lemon on the spot so it's nice and fresh. And that one lemon is pretty much bang on 40 mils.
Mm.
Now, an additional extra, because I couldn't resist, is a bottle of lavender bitters, which again smells very strongly of lavender. Adds some extra lavender excitement.
So just a few drops of
A few drops as usual with bitters. So give it a stir. And I'm going to serve this very simply. So I've literally put this into a long glass. No fanciness. I'm going to add some ice now. And then all I'm going to do is I'm going to top it up with a little bit of sparkling water. And then to garnish, I'm going to put in a sprig of dried lavender.
And a lavender-coloured straw.
Yeah, and a lavender-coloured straw and a green one, just to check it out. So have a go there and see what you think.
That looks very nice. It's very summery, actually, yeah. Doesn't it? Gosh, that's really nice. It's quite unexpected somehow.
I know!
This is quite sweet, isn't it?
It is sweet, yeah. And what I'm going to do now is basically make the same cocktail but without the gin to show you a kind of a non-alcoholic version, which really works very well.
Mm.
And it's just really a refreshing summer drink.
Mm.
And all I'm doing is I put literally a glug of the cordial, the juice of half a lemon, in a glass.
So just half a lemon?
Just half a lemon.
Yeah.
Stick in some ice. And this is the kind of thing that I often make a big jug of, you know, people are sitting out in my tiny garden.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I use elderflower cordial, you know, ginger syrup, whatever I have in the fridge.
Mm.
And it always goes down a treat, actually.
Right, and no bitters in this one.
Well, you could if you wanted to.
Yeah, it's good.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's refreshing.
It's different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I was surprised as well because I really liked it, but I gave it to somebody who I didn't think would enjoy lavender, and they really liked it. So I was really quite surprised, actually. So it's not just one for old ladies, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
So let's have just a quick summary of the alcoholic cocktail, shall we?
Okay. Once you've made your lavender cordial, which if you want to go into exact details, have a look on my blog. We need 40 mils of the lavender cordial, 40 mils of your finest gin, and 40 mils of lemon juice, freshly squeezed. Put it in a glass with lots of ice, top up with sparkling water.
And a bit of bitters.
Oh yes, of course. Thank you, Alan. Some bitters. Now, the one thing I'll say is, probably not many people have lavender bitters, but if you have them, this is the cocktail you've been looking for. That bottle of bitters that's wasting away at the bottom of your cupboard, this is the cocktail for you.
The manufacturers will be very grateful.
Yes.
Thank you to Aoife Maxwell for that. And you can see the recipe and some very enticing photos at Aoife's blog, sweetpeasandsours.com. So, time for our final feature. Last weekend was the 5th annual Food and Garden Produce Fair held on Parker's Peace. Matt, I think you like going to these, don't you?
Oh yeah, I love the food marquees. I love chatting with the vendors who come around and the cookery demonstration tent. Now, this usually has demos from local restaurants and gastropubs. I can't cover everything in this feature because it would just take far too long. But what I do tend to do is take a small snippet, a few voices from the weekend, and accompanied on this occasion by the Cottenham Brass Band. The English Spirit Distillery Company is an expert artisanal distillery. They hail from Dullingham in Cambridgeshire, and I'm speaking with John Walters. Now, one thing caught my attention in your literature, the fact that you produce your gin in these vast 200-litre copper pot stills. Now, I've been to another distillery, but there it was all glass stills and much smaller.
Well, they're two totally different things. First off, when you're using a glass still, you're actually not making any alcohol or collecting them. Glass stills or rotovaps are generally for the production of flavours that then someone else would add to an alcohol to make a gin that way. It's called compounding. Whereas what we do is very straight distilling. So 200 litre copper pot stills I've chosen because without doubt they simply make the best spirit. And the rationale for that is that when you're distilling something, you have bits that come off first called the heads, the good stuff that comes off next called the heart, and things that come off at the end called the tails, which add bitter notes. And the real skill of distilling is to ensure that really you only use the heart in your manufacture. And at 200 litres, with the right amount of energy input, around about 15 kilowatts, you can separate the heads
from the heart
from the tails.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfectly, without any overlap. If you have overlap, for example, if you have heads, they're going to add fire and aggression to a spirit. And if you linger for too long into the tails, then you're going to have a lot of bitter notes.
I tried the old-fashioned English toffee vodka yesterday. It was exactly as I hoped it would be, which was intensely sweet, very, very strong, deliciously sweet, I would say, and such a thick consistency. Has this been one of your large sellers over the weekend?
We always do a vast amount of it. I think there's a growing trend to sort of flavoured vodkas, particularly in a sweeter style, and toffee vodkas have come along. By and large, sadly, they tend to be made up with artificial colourings and all sorts, so they can be made on a mass scale. Where our view is that, you know, if you're going to make something, it should be the best that you can possibly do and stay true to the name on the bottle type of stuff. And so when we were making our old-fashioned toffee vodka, we spent a bit of time working out how to make a damn good toffee. So we used 5 caramelised sugars and a hint of freshly sort of slit Indian vanilla pods. So that's kind of the toffee base. It's quite a challenge because alcohol and sugar really don't like each other. They find it very, very difficult to interact and dissolve. And so when we're making it, it really does help, you know, if you've got a very strong arm, because you're going to do an awful lot of shaking and stirring to get the two to dissolve and away to go. And that's kind of what we try and do most of the time.
So if anybody would like to know more about the English Spirit Distillery, your contact details?
Yeah, so you can come along to us. We're based in Dullingham. EnglishSpiritDistillery.com. We'll find us on the web. The telephone number is 01638 507 981. 01638 507 981. Or simply, if you're passing by, there are plenty of signs. Everybody's welcome. Just pop in anytime between 9 to 5.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to chat. I do adore that English toffee, and it's just the perfect taste for someone with a very intensely sweet tooth. So thank you very much.
Great. Please, you enjoyed it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Cheers.
And now I'm here with Mark Peacock from the company It's All About Cheese. Mark, welcome to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Hi.
Now, It's All About Cheese. It's more than just cheese, isn't it? You also have jams, chutneys, marmalades, and a lot of these have alcoholic notes and flavours about them.
That's very true. I only sell, as I call them, boozy jams. They've got champagne, kirsch, whiskey, etc. in them.
And one that caught my eye, you have real ale chutney. I think that's a completely new one on me. I love chutneys. Are people here really picking up? Are they noticing this real ale one?
They pick up on the real ale one because it's so different. It's actually a mild ale, which is very difficult to get hold of nowadays. And this particular mild ale is from Yorkshire.
Now, as for your cheeses, now my favourite, I felt, by a country mile was the whiskey and ginger, the whiskey mac, as you call it.
Yeah.
I took this flavour away with me yesterday because people, I imagine, would remember long after they've left this event. Which ones here have been particularly favourable this weekend?
Always a really strong mature cheddar, always sells very well. You can go to the supermarkets and the local shops or the cheesemonger and get lots of cheese, but you can't get unusual flavoured cheese. So like the whiskey mac, which has got stem ginger and whiskey mixed in with it, is very unique. That, they'll buy the one with the red wine and caramelised onion, and they'll buy something with chilli in it, just for taste sensations, really. And, you know, they go with that.
I was hoping they're not overlooking the cheddar that you have, because that cheddar is just gorgeous. It's the creamiest cheddar I've ever had. It's head and shoulders above supermarket cheddar.
Yeah, well, the trouble with supermarket cheddars, they want to produce them as fast as they can. So they want to get the pH level down in the cheese really quick, so it gets the whey away for it. They can get it into presses and they can get it out selling it as fast as can. You know, a proper cheese needs time to bring the pH level down, mature, lovingly salted, and then it's generally ready to go, probably after about 12 months.
And do you have any particular favourites amongst your own cheeses?
I think the mature cheddar is by far my favourite, but I really do like it. It's a very old, traditional Cheshire. It's got some sourtone textures to it and everything with it.
Well, Mark, thanks for taking the time to chat to me. This is Mark Peacock of the company itsallaboutcheese.co.uk, which is a website that should be coming online soon.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
OK then, Mark, thanks very much, and I'm glad this weekend has gone so well for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm here in the at the back of the kitchen, at the rear of the cookery demonstration tent, the glory pit, I think you called it, Sophie.
Absolutely. It's all the bits that most people don't see. We try and look as if it just sort of happens fluidly out of the front.
Now, I'm here with Sophie Grigson. You're famous for, well, most famous for, in 1993, I think you did the Channel 4 series Grow Your Own Greens, Eat Your Greens,
Eat Your Greens, yeah.
And also, you're a very well-established food writer.
Uh-huh.
So you've won quite a few awards for your writing. There was Gourmet Ingredients over 20 years ago, I understand.
Yeah. You have to.
Why am I so obsessed with dates? Because I'm a guy. I'm obsessed with facts and figures
that
and dates.
That figures, really, doesn't it? Yes.
It does figure.
Yes.
Yeah. And you won the Guild of Food Writers Cookery Journalist Award. Mm-hmm. I think that was about 13 years ago.
I have absolutely no idea, because I'm a woman and it's not that important.
But you did get started with 50 Ways with Potatoes. This was your first article for the Sunday Express?
It was my first. 50 Ways with Potatoes was the first article I got paid for. And my actual first article was how to make a cheese souffle and impress potential boyfriends when I was a student at Manchester.
At UMIST?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, he has done his homework.
You did a degree in maths and French and then you dropped the French, was that right?
Oh, this is scary. This is really scary. Yes, I did.
Now, there was a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about, which you explained during your cookery demonstration today. Mm-hmm. One of them was, I'm a cook, not a chef.
Yeah.
So you're saying that you've never been formally trained.
Never had formal training at all.
Mm. And it was just to explain the distinction to the listener in your mind between a cook and a chef, because standing next to us is Ondine Hartgrove.
Yes.
And you are a master chef contestant. You went back to college and you trained professionally. Now you have a private business and you'll soon be teaching. You'll be opening your own school soon,
yeah,
is that right?
I do teach at the moment, but I am opening my own school very soon.
Lovely. What's the name of the school?
Do you know, I haven't actually decided yet.
Ondine School.
Well, yeah, but I don't want to be mixed up with somebody else because there's a restaurant with my name, how dare they?
That's not odd.
I know, because I wanted it to be Ondine. It still might be Ondine's.
You describe yourself as a cook and you describe Ondine as a chef.
There are many ways I can describe Ondine. all of them very complimentary. Well, yes, because as chef, I really don't like the way the word chef has now been taken up. I hate to say by the media, and it's bandied around that everybody is suddenly a chef, because a chef actually has to put in some hard work, some training, usually has experience in professional kitchens, and restaurant cooking is not the same as domestic cooking. Very, very different. And one of the sad things about domestic cooking is that we don't have a team of skivvies to do all the cleaning and the washing up. Mm. You know, so that instantly makes it different.
And the other thing, which you mentioned as well in your talk, was that you don't like the reference to signature dishes, which is how you're advertised in the local paperwork here, unfortunately. Sophie Grigson will be here displaying two of her signature dishes.
This is a very recent thing. The past couple of years, people have become obsessed with the idea of signature dishes. But I have to say that I think it's a very poor chef, or indeed cook, who can only do one or two dishes really well. I mean, you should be, if that's your profession, you should be doing lots of different dishes, and dishes that have connections with the seasons, with location, with place, and not actually just stick to two signature dishes.
Now, you did mention that you're a big fan of rapeseed oil over other oils, and also, Ondine, you mentioned as well that you describe it as a carrier oil.
Yes. What I mean by that is the fact that there's very little taste to it. It's quite a neutral oil, which means it makes it very, very versatile, so you can add other flavours to it, and they will actually let those shine rather than the taste of the actual oil, whereas olive oil is predominantly the taste of olives. Mm. Yeah, so it's not always that easy to carry other flavours with it, whereas, like I say, we have the versatility from the rapeseed, so you can use it through endless different cuisines, really.
Now, today you've been doing a cookery demonstration on pad thai, and you told us a really cool story whilst you were cooking. Your favourite Christmas, where you're in the Orient.
I think quite a lot of pad thais that are far too sweet, and I wanted to show, A, how easy it is to do at home, also to show that you don't need to load it down with lots and lots of sugar, that it tastes actually better without that heavy-handed use of sugar. And I just love it. Yeah,
yeah,
it's very simple.
It for lunch.
Yes, we wanted it for our lunch. Yeah, that was it, really.
You did say a lot of pad thais out there are a bit too heavy on the sweet rather than the sour, and you wanted to equalise that a little.
Yes, I just wanted to show that you don't need to do that. But yes, my first ever visit to Thailand was a long time ago, and we had our Christmas lunch underneath a flyover in Bangkok. My friend who I was travelling with had brought a fantastic bottle of wine from England, so we had it slightly tepid because we didn't have any ice, and with great food from the food stalls all around us, and a bit of traffic fumes to season it.
Well, love you. Thank you very much. Love you. Well,
you
love
can
me.
Love
thank
me
you.
If you like. I
will.
Love you
I will.
Too, darling.
Yeah.
I love you.
Yeah.
I love you, Ondine. I love you.
Too,
I love
Sophie.
Matt.
I love you too, Sophie. This has been very fun for me. Thank you very much. I look forward to your next demonstration. You're out next.
I am indeed. I'm just about to go and do some other things. I'm going to do what I'm making, gnocchi.
Gnocchi, yes.
Yes.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ah, that was a great time, and very nice to have a celebrity chef there too, to speak to her and to try the food.
We're so lucky that Cambridge does often have food and drink related fairs on around the year, and Flavour likes to cover a lot of them. The next big event is the Mill Road Winter Fair in December, which we always look forward to.
Now on to Cambridge's food and drink news. There's a pop-up food park at Milton Country Park on Sunday the 21st of September, so tomorrow, from 11 till 4.
And on Wednesday the 24th, the Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherry Hinton Road will have a Chilean wine tasting of 6 wines for £15. Chilean wines have improved massively in the last few years, and this is such a good chance to sample them in the presence of the man who produces these wines, Dan Ojfell of the Ojfell Winery in Chile. And you can book tickets via the cambridgewine.com website.
Now, the Grub Club launches on the 23rd of September at the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop. That'll be from 6.30 until 10.30 in the evening, and it'll feature pulled pork, salads, desserts, gin tastings and treats. Tickets are £36, and you can book via the Eventbrite website.
Local Boys Steak and Honour are one of the finalists to watch out for at the 2014 British Street Food Awards, which is taking place from the 26th to the 28th of September in Leeds.
And finally, there's a new vinyl store with a cafe opening soon, next to Cutlax in Mill Road. That would, of course, place it on the Romsey side of Mill Road. And that about wraps up another edition of Flavour. So if you really enjoyed it, if you really enjoyed us, you can listen to a repeat of the programme tomorrow at 7 a.m.
And please do keep in touch with Cambridge Food and Drink News by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. And previous editions of the programme are also available on iTunes and our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
Coming up next is Bookmark with Lee Chambers and Alex Roget. At 2 p.m, it's Best of the Guests with Phil Rowe, a compilation of voices from the city. At 3, it's Radio Dante, the show for Italians in Cambridge, and, well, all who enjoy Italian culture, in fact. And then from 4 p.m, we've got 2 hours of Sports Live with Alistair Hunter and Jack Swindlehurst.
So thanks so much to all our interviewees today. Our next episode is in 2 weeks' time on Saturday the 4th of October, so we hope you can join us then. For now, it's goodbye from Flavour.
Goodbye!
Goodbye!